Welcome to Be Nice or Leave. I'm your host, Polly Hammond. In a world where businesses are facing new challenges and heightened competition, empathy is becoming an increasingly important tool to better understand your customers, improve communication, and ultimately lead to increased profits. Through interviews with business leaders and experts, this series explores the ways in which empathy can help organizations overcome these challenges, to be better and to do better. Most importantly, we'll hear from the people who have made it happen and can see the positive impact it has had on their organization. So whether you're a business leader, an entrepreneur, or simply someone interested in the intersection of empathy and business, Be Nice or Leave is the podcast for you. Today, we're excited to welcome Francis Tang to the podcast. Francis is the founder and CEO of Awkward Essentials, a company that's all about making personal hygiene solutions for hella personal problems. Francis is the mastermind behind the Dripstick, the after-cleanup sponge that's been turning heads and changing the game in the personal hygiene space. Francis is a big believer in experiential marketing, and her irreverent sense of humor shines through in everything she does. We're excited to chat with her today about her journey, the importance of sexual empowerment, and the future of Awkward Essentials. So, let's get into it. Francis, welcome. I'm so pleased to have you here. I discovered you and Awkward Essentials, I want to say, in 2020. Is that right? Is that the year that you founded the brand?
For the most part, I mean, early 2019, but you know, it was like me and my parents' house.
Was it? That's so great. And then 2020 and everyone's staying at home and suddenly a product like a post-sex sponge has so much more importance during all of those at home together times. Welcome. So you are super public. You're actually fabulous to Google. And I'm going to say at the beginning, normally I leave the Googling until the end of a podcast, but I actually think people will like this podcast so much more if they just stop right now and go and Google Francis Tang and Awkward Essentials. Because you have a background in comms and marketing, and you have done a great job publicizing and promoting the brand. But for everyone who's listening, who's not going to stop and Google, they're in their cars. Can you just give us a kick down on what that original product in 2019 and 2020 was?
Yeah. So right now we are Awkward Essentials, but back in 2019, years ago, before everything, before the pandemic, the name of the company was actually Come and Gone. And so based on the product, and the product was called Come and Gone. As was the company, and it's an after-sex cleanup sponge. So it's to get the cum out of your vagina, hence the name was Come and Gone. We eventually did rebrand to Awkward Essentials so we could just kind of address other behind the bathroom door problems, things that people feel self-conscious about, but they're just like too afraid to talk about. So that's really our objective. I think a lot of people think that we are a sex company because our product deals with the aftermath of sex, but it's not like sexy. It's like fun to talk about because it's something we can relate to, or it's kind of like pimple popping, like kind of like, but I can't stop watching. But at the same time, it's not a pleasure product. It's very utilitarian. And so we really like those utilitarian solutions to things that are happening in the bathroom that people are scared to talk about.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because when I was talking to my husband about this in preparing for the podcast, I was saying, and I was kind of uncomfortable saying it, I was like, well, it's utilitarian in the same way that a tampon is utilitarian. Like, it's not, you know, it literally has a function that's very specific in our lives. Not that the two items are in any way equitable other than utility. And that's why I say I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that. But I couldn't think of that many other things as I'm describing it to a bloke. You changed the name and you changed it to Awkward Essentials. And it's such a good segue into, you know, some of my early questions about how do you actually do product research in a category where the whole topic is so taboo? How do you get customer feedback? And how do you realize that I'm not the only person who's sitting here at 2 a.m. thinking to myself, well, it'd be a really good idea to have a post-sex cleanup sponge. You know, do you go out to friends? Do you go out for like actual focus groups? How does that happen?
It was hard. I did think I was the only one. And every time I went through that after sex cleanup process, I would Google it. And you could find different things on the internet, right? Like you can find everything on the internet. So there's different like Yahoo Answers forums and like Reddit forums, places like that where people were kind of talking about it. And they were talking about using like towels or old t-shirts or baby wipes, which are fantastic solutions for the outside. But in my founder brain, I was like, okay, that's for the outside, but it's inside. And that's my problem, right? And when it's dripping out overnight, when it's dripping out the next day, when I'm feeling uncomfortable or it's like getting my underwear wet, it's because it's inside. It's not because I didn't like wipe the outside. It's because it's like stuck inside. And so the inspiration for the product came from baking. It came from a rubber spatula. You might've read it when you Googled me. So I love baking. And every time I would scrape cake batter out of a bowl, cake batter is very thick. It is very viscous. I would think, wow, it would be so fantastic to have a spatula for my vagina so I could just kind of get everything out in one fell swoop. But I knew that a spatula probably wouldn't be the best or like most hygienic or safest solution for this. So where I started was thinking about what already exists. So I think for early stage founders, like not starting from scratch and leveraging work and research that has already been done by bigger companies. And so when I was thinking about this, I was like, okay, I did test the tampon. It didn't work. It turned into this like slimy thing that just like slid out of my vagina. I know some people use it for that use case, but that's not the intention. So I wouldn't do it personally, but I did test it to see if cotton would be a good solution or a good material, and it didn't work. And so I thought, okay, well, cum is a lot more viscous than like blood. It's like thicker, right? So what could something that has bigger pores, you need something with bigger pores to like absorb and grab a viscous fluid. And so I was like, okay, a sponge. So I looked at a lot of different like sponges, hospital swabs, and I landed on the contraceptive sponge, which is something that has existed for a long time and is perfectly safe. The contraceptive sponge has a lot of additives, and so I knew I didn't want our product to have any additives. And so that's kind of where I started. Just, and then I guess to give a little bit more color around what I'm saying for leveraging what exists, knowing that tampon companies have a lot of money and have research teams and have done this work that was for like the size and length. So knowing, okay, that's probably the average length and size. And then thinking through how I want people to use the product and how I want to make it obvious. Because when you're bringing something brand new to the market, there's a lot of education involved, which is an uphill battle. So the reason why it has a handle is so people don't put their pants back on, right? So they don't treat it like a tampon. So they know that they can't like have sex with it in their body, because we get that question a lot. Let me actually show you. So this is the product. This is Dripstick. It's a medical grade sponge about the length of a tampon. It's soft, it's squishy, and it has a handle so that you don't leave it inside. And so you basically just insert it, twist it around, and then remove it, and then the cum is gone.
Awesome. So it's interesting that you say that, because one of the things that I work in food and beverage, and there's like professionally, and so often they're working on shoestring budgets and no margins. And I often will say, okay, but people with more money than you have done the research. What are they already doing? Like, don't feel that you have to start from the very beginning, wherever that might be, you know, whether you want to call it your unfair advantage or not. Although I think that where you did start from the beginning, and we can talk about sort of that first to market advantage if we want, is that nobody at the time, there was not this wellspring of what I would describe as women's sexual wellness, D2C or online producers. Like nowadays we do actually, we've got like GetMod and we've got Vera and we've got a bunch of them, but you were one of the first people who was actually out there speaking to a very, very specific audience need. Is that correct?
I want to say that there were or still are those brands, but I don't know. There's definitely more now. Like there's definitely this huge like groundswell of like sex tech, femtech brands. Like I get a lot of different first-time founders that like reach out to me that are starting something in this space. There just weren't as many, I guess. And our personality is like pretty loud, for better or worse. So we're definitely one of the loud ones.
Is the audience that you originally built the Dripstick, the very first product for, still your primary audience? Or how have you seen that change since you've been in market?
Yes and no. So initially in my mind, the target audience was someone who's like married in a long-term relationship, on birth control, like comfortable with letting their partner come in them, right? And so we do see that. We do have a lot of our customers do fit in that demographic. But then alternatively, we see, I don't know if you'd consider it the opposite, but just like a very different demographic, like people with multiple partners. There are a lot of men who purchase for their like wives, which I think is super interesting. And I think it's because we take a very utilitarian stance to the product, and like men are utilitarian people. Like she said she had this problem, this is the solution, I will get the solution and fix the problem. And so sometimes it actually backfires. We'll get like men who like email us and they're like, I got this from my wife and she got mad at me. Like, you know, so.
Really?
Oh, yeah, because it's like a weird, it's a weird thing. I think like as open as we are, there's still a lot of self-consciousness about sex in general, right? Like, I think a lot of people still are not comfortable talking about sex. They're talking about this other thing, which is like not even sexy at all. It's after, it's gooey, it's sticky, it's like weirder, is even harder to talk about. So I can totally understand why someone who may have complained about this being a problem would feel caught off guard if someone acknowledged it.
Well, I guess I just find interesting that it was men buying it for their wives and their wives were like, ooh, what's this? Because I look at it and my guess would have been, it would have been the other way around, that, you know, women would have this thing and men would be like, and there are no rules on this podcast, and men would be like, what do you mean? What do you mean?
Oh, 100%.
Comfortable? Like, how is it possible that I've had sex with all of these women and I never knew that there was a woman who was like, ooh, as you put it, I have to penguin walk to the bathroom now. So my take on it would have been that the men would have been the ones completely blindsided from lack of awareness.
There's both. So I think there are those thoughtful men who like hear, or I mean, I think it's like, it's both sides. So a lot of this is something that I think a lot of people don't even like talk about. They just go to the bathroom and deal with it, but they don't even say anything, right? And so I think there's that. So on one hand, I think a lot of women are not being vocal about it. But yes, on the other hand, when I was early, and even now, I still get a lot of men that are like, is this even a problem? Like, what do you mean? Is that what she's doing in the bathroom? I had no idea. Like,
they're and like, that's a whole different question, as a matter of fact, but, you know, partially. Okay. I'm really curious about this because I've got two daughters who are now early 20s. And I look at this and I think this is such an, I mean, I've talked about your product in my house since 2020 because I'm like, oh, I think this is super neat. One, because we can normalize something with, you know, especially with our daughters or with our children from a very early age perspective. And I actually want to ask about that. Is there this space where you've got parents or specifically mothers, but maybe dads who are like, oh, I wasn't aware of this. I found you through social media. And this is something that I just want to normalize with my kids.
We do have a private Facebook group. We haven't specifically gone into the parenting thing, but I will say that I've spoken to a lot of our customers and a lot of them are very similar to you in that they have older children and that they've almost used this as a way to like open up that conversation, which I think is really cool. Like we see that with people who are parents and just different couples. So different men or women that are like, oh, I saw this online. Is this actually a thing that you deal with? And then, yes, it is. Like, what else do you deal with that I have no idea, right? So it just almost acts as this like weird tool to open up the conversation. And if, whether they're laughing with us or at us, if it helps, then we don't care. That's like progress. That's an amazing thing.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. So whether they're laughing with us or at us, you have a very unique voice and tone. You use a lot of metaphors in the brand. You've got really, you have excellent creative design. Again, everybody needs to go look at the website with the Barbies and the whole thing on it. As you were scaling the brand over the past few years, you know, I'm going to veer into some tropes. Authenticity and storytelling is like, you know, it's part of that marketing language that unfortunately has been co-opted. But I do think actually you as the founder and the person to this day whose face is all over the website, you have actually really leaned into proper, honest storytelling. How much has that resonated with the audience? And how much of a difference has that made to the brand as you've grown it? That you as a person who's like, I know this is a totally weird product and I'm just going to sit here and we're going to have straight talk one-on-one about what and why we have these products.
Yeah. So when I initially launched it, it wasn't this personality at all. It was very, I mean, I did a accelerator in Los Angeles, actually. And I pitched it like you'd pitch any startup. So with like statistics and facts and things like that. And it just didn't go over well. And so at that time, there was an actor in the class. And I don't know how I can't remember how we came upon this, but I think Ali Wong's stand-up comedy special was very popular at that same time. And so I reconfigured that pitch to almost be more of like a stand-up routine. And a lot of stand-up is based in like personal storytelling and personal experience. And so that's how I redid my startup pitch, and it just hit a lot better. And so I realized that people were a lot more comfortable watching me and hearing this story and saying to themselves in their head, especially because it's a taboo topic, right? Saying to themselves in the head, like, oh, I actually have that problem too. Cool, I'll check it out. Like, I don't think people are going to raise their hand and be like, oh my God, yes, I hate this. My partner comes in me. It's so gross, right? Like, every once in a while, I do find those people, but for the most part, most are not comfortable doing that. So that is why it was rooted in my personal story. It wasn't because there was this pressure to be like authentic and storytelling and like face behind. It was really because the other method didn't work. Like, my intention was not to be the face of the cum sponge on the internet. And I think compared to a lot of other brands, I'm not that founder forward. Like, we actually go back and forth. How much do people actually care about the founder, or do they care more about the humor that draws them to our emails and to our Instagram page and to our brand? And so the whole brand personality, it is my personality on the internet, only because I couldn't really afford anything else. And it's the way that I look and think about the product. It's not that serious, right? Like, and I would rather, I think humor is such a great connector and such a great way to reach people. We have so many wonderful friends in this space that take a more serious tone or more of like a feminist forward tone, and we love them. And I am absolutely a feminist. Like, inherently our product is feminist, but because I just don't identify with those brands as strongly. And so my thought process was that the greater population, like, we could reach more people by leveraging humor.
Well, I mean, we love it simply because, so I have so many clients who are in the alcohol industry, and we've been saying for years, please, please, like, just be delightful. We live in spaces, whether it's wine and booze or whether it's having sex, these are things that actually bring joy to life. And it doesn't have to be something that's always so heavy. And it also doesn't mean that we're demeaning or diminishing the importance of the times when it is heavy, you know, but like, don't take something that's difficult and taboo and then add this whole weight on top of it.
You should talk to some sex educators.
Oh, really? Why? Tell me.
I think there's different types, like exactly what you're saying. It can coexist. Just because you make light of something does not mean that it isn't serious in other spaces or situations. It's contextual. Like, look at aviation gin, right? Like, Ryan Reynolds has always used humor throughout all the companies that he's found, and they just exited for whatever, $100 million. So it's possible. I think that because historically the sex space has been dominated by men and products have been created by men without the best intentions, there's like an automatic assumption that it is coming from that place. And it's not, but it almost acts as a barrier to anyone who potentially wants to use humor or take a more lighthearted tone or point of view about some of these things, right? Like in our mind, something is better than nothing. If it can get you to learn one or two great things or teach you that you do need to pee after sex, so you don't get a UTI, that's better than like alienating someone and just never getting that message across.
When I look at the product, and this is only my read on it, I think to myself that something like this actually starts to level the playing field for when, where, how, and why women can have sex. You know, like the notion of having sex in a club bathroom was never that easy. Having sex in the back of a car, all these things that, to be fair, a dude can have sex wherever he wants. And it's really easy because you don't have like this logistics of it. And that's something like, is that the kind of feedback? Is that consideration that you have that without going too heavy, although we will before we finish, without going too heavy into the feminism and the politics of it, that this is literally about just making it easier for us to get off when and where we want to.
Yeah. Like, I think that there's a huge, I'm actually a mom now, and there's this huge mental load that we deal with 24/7. And this is included, right? Like, you're always thinking three steps ahead. Like, okay, well, if I want to go for a run tomorrow morning, if we have sex tonight, then it's going to make my run suck. Or like, if I, you know, want to ride Peloton tonight, but then we have sex, then it just like, there's always so much planning and thinking going on.
And or so I'm in my grandmother's house and I'm being sneaky. And if I want to have sex, it means I'm going to have to run to the bathroom. And then there's a likelihood that somebody's going to know what. Yeah.
There's so many things. And so we actually heard from a lot of like mental health therapists and like couples therapists that our product has helped people have more sex, which is really cool, right? Like, honestly, the idea behind it was just like, hey, like the cleanup is a pain and I don't want to deal with the aftermath. But to know that it's helping people feel more comfortable and confident to have sex whenever they want to, wherever they want to, more often, like it's awesome. And then alternatively, we tell people like, if this doesn't bother you, if it's not a problem, if you like it, like that's cool. Like, you do not need this product, right? And we try to make it so clear. And I think in this space in particular, you have to make it clear. Or not this space. I think it's this day and age with social media, right? Because people see like 2-3 seconds of something and then there's like automatic assumptions made. And so people kind of assume that, I don't know, that we created this because like we're like forcing it on everyone. And we're like, no, like if you like the cum, you like the drip, it doesn't bother you. He doesn't come inside you. He comes somewhere else. Like, that's totally fine. Like, you don't need our product.
And so, we're not prescribing how you have to have sex, right?
Yeah. But just in general that the assumptions or the quick beliefs that people have based on social media have made marketing a lot harder nowadays.
If I recall correctly, you went viral. I hate that word. You had a pretty popular TikTok early campaign. Is that right? Back in kind of early founder days. I don't know which name it was under.
Yeah, we've had a couple different viral TikToks, and typically it's just like, hey, this is the cum sponge, like that's it.
So you're not like trying to go viral, not in that way that marketers hear from clients, which is like, ooh, I really want to go viral. Like, that's really not it. It's just sort of on the radar, gets picked up by algorithm, gets distributed.
Yeah, I think it's just because we sit in between sex and hygiene, and so obviously people are interested in sex. But because it's something that a lot of us can relate to, but aren't comfortable talking about, I think it just has the right combination of it being taboo enough, but sex related. But it's kind of like when you go into the girls' bathroom and then there's like girls you don't know in there, but you're like in this safe space. And then once the first girl is like, does anyone have a tampon? Or like, do you guys use a period cup? It just opens up the floodgate for that conversation. I feel like that's kind of who we are.
That's so true, whether you know them or not. I wanted to ask some questions based on your TikTok experience. One of the things that we saw is that we have a lot of experts. We have OBGYNs, we've got sexual health, but we also have nutritionists, and we had you know, doctors who are pro-vaccination. Like, we had a lot of experts on TikTok who were specifically using a platform where the parents weren't, or maybe the significant others weren't, that, you know, that it was exclusive to an audience. So first question, did you find that on TikTok, you've got that primarily sort of, you know, what would it be, up to 25-year-old audience?
I would say it's actually millennials and older.
Really? On TikTok?
Yeah. There's like TikTok for all kinds of people. And so I don't think that TikTok is this Gen Z 16 to 25 only platform anymore. I do think that, I mean, and I think the pandemic actually accelerated that, right? Like, people were home. The algorithm is so good. So people, Gen Z and up, you know, we're all on the platform.
Wow. Okay. So that kind of feeds into my next question, which is, you were on TikTok, but you have a community that's a private group on Facebook. And I was just curious, from a marketer's standpoint, is, did you have any challenges with getting them to like jump platforms, right? From having the TikTok presentation into private conversations on Facebook?
I think it's a different audience, 100%. So we use TikTok a lot for discovery. And so although we go viral a lot, right, the amount of views do not equate the amount of sales or conversions.
Of course. But
on Facebook, that is that target market, like those folks that are in long-term relationships, most likely on birth control. And they came from our email list. So kind of the way that our life cycle works, which I think is a lot the way a lot of brands work, is that when we go viral, a lot of people, you know, head to our website, or they'll sign up for email, SMS, and then that's where we tell them about our Facebook group. And so if they are interested enough in the brand, in where we're going, in what we're saying, to join the Facebook group, that's how we've built that community.
And do you moderate that yourself, or have you actually had to scale up with community moderators?
I'm in there for the most part, and then our social media person is in there too. But for the, it kind of has taken on a life of its own. Like, we like it to just be a safe space. I like that it's kind of like the girls' bathroom, that someone is like, hey, last night XYZ happened. Has this happened to any of you? Or do you know, have you ever tried this? It is a place to tell people if we're launching something new, or to like hook them up. But for the most part, I just want it to be like an open forum. And I think everyone in there is almost like a clone of me, or a clone of our brand. Like, their personalities are very similar to the brand because we have a strong brand personality.
Right, right. Which is so important to call out. In the context of safe spaces, did you have to sit down and think about what your mailing packaging looked like so that somebody could receive this quietly without a significant other or their parents knowing what it is? And if so, is that at all at odds with this really loud brand voice and brand personality?
Yes, it is at odds. But I would rather people have the product and be more empowered to like use it and have sex more often and more comfortably than, you know, have our brand everywhere. And so I think what's funny is that people assume that they're like mailman, like, is like looking at their packages super closely, or that their mailman or neighbors actually know who we are, which would be very flattering, but they don't, right? We're not that big. Like, they do not know who we are. And so our investors are men, and they were operating half to start. They helped us with the operations piece, and they like insisted that we put the branding on the box. And I did not want the branding on the box. I had to like make my case for why I did not want our branding on the box. And we got so many upset people. And so I was finally able to like win my case. And now the package says Richard Cummings. So there's no trace of Awkward Essentials anywhere on the outer box.
Are you willing to talk a little bit about funding and some of the challenges there?
Mm-hmm, totally.
Okay, so initial funding, female founder sits in an in-between spot between sex and health, right? You did go through an accelerator program. What was your experience in seeking funding for the original enterprise?
It was really hard. It was probably what a lot of other female founders have said on your podcast. I hit up like women's funds, VCs first. a lot of people just wanted proof of concept. And I don't blame them, right? This is a product that's never existed. I think that it's hard to make a big bet on something that's never existed because it's like, why has it never existed? There must not be a market. I get it. It makes total sense, right? Marketing Brain Francis understands that. So the way I found our investors was seeing who invested in other brands that have really loud personalities that were doing things that haven't quite been done before. So our investors invested in Tushy Bidets, and Tushy has a very loud personality. And so I was like, okay, if they like loud, like obviously they're comfortable with loud personalities. They're comfortable with topics like poop, potentially, you know, like things like that. So
the language is not going to scare them off.
Exactly. And so that was how I found them. But yeah, it wasn't easy. I think they say like, oh, talk to friends and family and angels, but it's like, where do I find angels? My friends and family don't have that much money. Like it's, I think the conventional advice online is for a certain kind of person, but it's not easy for a female founder to just like follow that advice.
Why?
I think there's not enough women in positions that can fund us without bias.
What do you mean by without bias?
So there are a lot fewer. Well, there's a couple of different things. There's a really interesting article that came out. I'll have to send it to you. And I'm like nervous to try to state the takeaway because I might get it wrong. But essentially there was a study done that said, okay, if a female founder is funded by a female VC, they're less likely to raise another round.
Really?
Because there's this like unconscious bias that like, I think it's like funds like, but then if it's the same female founder that has like a male VC and like their seed round or initially, then they are likely to get that second round.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. Definitely send that through.
I'll send it to you. And then I think that there's this other separate piece where there's fewer female funders. And so they have to make good bets, because if they don't make good bets, then there's just going to be this assumption like, oh, you only invested in her because she was like a woman. And that's like fucked up. Right. But it's this weight and this pressure that's like on their shoulders. And so if they have to make good bets, then they're looking for a lot more proof of concept. Like, I don't want to say an unreasonable, but just like a lot more. And so it's harder to take chances on
they
early
can't be
stage
risky.
Companies.
You can't just risk. Because it's detrimental, you know, to everyone in a way when that happens. So you sit then in between your investors and your audience. And, you know, I think that one of the things, like when we do talk about empathy in business, I think it's really easy to get all swept up in only the customer facing empathy, which of course is so important. But also as you're doing, you know, as you describe this, being able to quote walk a mile, right, in the funder shoes, and what do they need? I'm curious to know, for you, were there any challenges beyond just the packaging that you spoke about, especially as you went to roll out new products that you had to explain? You know, you really had to go to bat with your investors over why you're going to launch a sleepover kit or why you're going to go into lube and, you know, vibrators. So was that the sort of thing that they were just like, yeah, there's money in it? Or were you like, look, here's the reason that we're doing this?
I think there have been some things. It hasn't necessarily been products. I think it just depends on the background of the investors, right? Like some investors have built businesses or done things one way and they feel like that's the way to do things. And so while their intentions might be good, like I did it this way, so you should do it this way and it'll work and the outcome will be the same, which, you know, that's like impossible. And so it was a little bit of pushback around that, but I mean, the
intentions. And that's just in terms of practices, growth practices, where you put your money, how you chose to market, grow, position yourself, that kind of
thing. Yeah, exactly. Okay. I mean, like taking on an investor, they say it's like a marriage, but I think it's like a baby daddy, right? Like your business is your baby and that's your daddy. And they're not like, you can't get divorced, right? Like they're your they're your baby daddy forever. Sorry. And so you have to just be very careful and think very carefully about it.
Right. I noticed that in your speaking in the video reel that is on the 10% discount on the site, and then in some of the blog posts and some of the articles, as well as in the Barbie imagery, that you've often leaned heavily into metaphor when you're describing the brand. And I'm curious how much of that has to do with brand personality choice and how much of that has to do with regulations, with things like monetization on YouTube, where we know that we're going to get strikes, or even, you know, can you even advertise on Google? Like, what are the implications of having a sex brand?
It's mostly just because of brand personality, because we also have no problem saying like cum or jizz. Like, you should see our Slack channel. It's like terrible, but
that's awesome.
It's fun. But we are careful around the paid stuff. So because our product is utilitarian and kind of hygiene, it's not, we're able to kind of get through and get by.
What are the implications of some of the new products that you have for sale on that utilitarian? Like, and this, I could just be old and a fuddy-duddy and making a wrong assumption, but can we actually make a case for a vibrator as utilitarian?
I mean, I think we can, but Google doesn't.
I think every woman in the room is going to say we can, but Google doesn't think so. Okay.
Yeah.
So there is,
Mr. Google is like, no. Yeah. So, so we are able to advertise on the major platforms like Facebook, Instagram, Google. We don't advertise vibrators there, but pleasure products isn't really the direction we want to go in. Like the vibrators things was kind of a test to see, because a lot of our audience was like, we want vibrators. And so we're like, okay, well, if we do them, is there a way we can do them a little bit differently or have that messaging be different? But I can tell you, so, I mean, our other product that is like, not as big as Dripstick, but like we have our pee funnel. So I think you probably saw this, right?
Yeah, describe it for the listeners.
Yeah, so this is our disposable pee funnel. It comes in like a flat, I don't know, are you going to be doing video or?
No, I won't use video, but I'll put links in.
Okay, perfect. So our disposable pee funnel comes in a flat, resealable kind of like stasher bag. And so it's folded into thirds. You take it out, you pop it open, and then you can pee standing up. So you don't have to like touch the porta potty. Maybe there is no potty because you're like on a road trip or camping or like at a festival or something.
I was about to say a nasty festival and you're like, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And so it comes with toilet paper. It comes with hand sanitizer, and then it has the bag in case you cannot find a trash can. And so we know that we're not the first to pee funnels, but we tried to pull together all the things that we felt like we would truly want. Like, you need toilet paper, right? Or like you like want hand sanitizer, or sometimes there's no trash can and you don't want to put it back in your backpack. So we have our pee funnel. And then actually today we just launched, we call them sticky tits, but they're like sticky boobs, like chicken cutlets.
So they're chicken, they're nipple hiders.
Yeah, the nipple covers. So you don't have to wear a bra.
Yeah.
Because like, who actually likes wearing a bra? And then I became a mom like a year ago, and I like, wearing a bra became even worse than before.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So just kind of going back to that market research, as you're rolling out new products and you've been very honest about the vibrators, like, are you using the community as a feedback loop, or are you watching Google Trends, or are you sitting around collectively and, you know, throwing 1,000 ideas on the table? Like, staying true to your audience, how does new product development happen?
A lot of it is from my brain, which probably isn't the most data-informed way to do it.
But it's truthful.
But it is, right? So it's like the weird, gross things that I'm doing in the bathroom that I'm like, huh, like, why is there no, like,
awesome.
There's got to be a better way to do this, right? Like, this is gross, but this is oddly satisfying. Is there a way to scale this? Like, I have founder brain. It's a problem. It's a disease. Mm-hmm. But that's where a lot of it comes from. And then we will do the external research after Francis is like, oh, what if we make a razor that does this, or like a mirror for the shower so you can shave your vulva better? Just like different.
Yeah. Okay. So that's such a great segue. Early days, you went out, you had this idea. How do you get something like this manufactured? Like, where do you go? And you're like, all right, here's my idea. I want 20,000 of them. You know, I'm just so curious about the actual manufacturing of everything that you produce.
I just tracked down medical manufacturers and I told them like what I wanted, the material I wanted. I have like crude drawings that I did that I just took photo. Like I couldn't do a rendering. I don't know how to do a rendering.
I'm like, are you 3D printing, you know, the things in the house that you're like, okay, and this is the handle for comfort and all of this. I think it's fabulous, but I also would love to know because that I think that the how things get done is often the impediment, right? That you can sit there, you can go through the whole process of it, but then how do I actually take this concept and turn it into a tangible product is just sometimes really bewildering.
Yeah, and I think it often involves the scariest decision, and a lot of people avoid that decision. A lot of people are like planning. Even me, I was planning, and my dad was like, okay, like, are you just gonna keep planning? And I'm like, no, but this has to be perfect first. The website has to be up, or this has to be up. And he's just like, that's not actually gonna like get you anywhere. And so a lot of people, they're like, can you 3D print it? Can you do a prototype? I did buy like a bunch of different like medical foams and swabs and sponges and things that I could find on the internet and kind of like try to like hack pieces together, but it just didn't feel like it was going in the right direction. And so it goes against all startup, all business advice to order 20,000, because that was like the minimum that I needed. Like, you're not supposed to invest that much until you have proof of concept. But I had a really hard time getting proof of concept because it was such an educational thing, right? People would like hear me describe it and they would think like, oh, it's a suction machine or it's a towel or it's a wipe. And I'd be like, no, it goes in afterwards. And they're like, I don't understand. And so I really had to have a lot of conviction in thinking like, okay, once they see it in their hand, they see the actual physical product, they will understand it. So in my case, I did get lucky and people did understand it. There is still so much education that has to go into it. But it was getting like medical grade samples from different medical factories and then kind of piecing things together and then just drawing out like, okay, this is what I want the final one to look like.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you see the brand growing and what your goals are and anything exciting and awesome that we can learn from you?
By the time this episode airs, we'll be in a bunch of CVSs across the nation. And so if you want to find us, you can go to our website, awkwardessentials.com, and the store locator, and you'll be able to find one near you. We're also in a couple of different sex shops and of course online at awkwardessentials.com.
That's so brilliant. Thanks a million, Francis. I'm so grateful for your time.
Thank you, Polly.
And that's a wrap. A huge thanks to Francis for joining me today and to you, my amazing listeners, for hanging out with us. We couldn't do this without you. If you're interested in learning more about how empathy can transform your business for good, make sure to hit that subscribe button. And if you have any questions or feedback, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me online at fiveforest.com or on social media at fiveforest. I'll add the links to the description. See you next time.